Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, we're going to be taking a look. It's actually the last in our series of programs that we've been doing with Tom Plager. Tom's Dean and Campus Executive Officer, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW-Baraboo Sauk County campus, talking about the history of Native Americans here in Wisconsin. It's been really interesting. I've had some great feedback from you about it, and I'm glad to have Tom back as we talk about that period, the European discovery, settlement of North America, that sort of ended the long and separate and independent development of Indian cultures here. And it's usually referred to as the historic period. So we'll talk with him about that today. And you may have questions. Hope you do. And I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Dean Tom Plager, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us by phone today.
Oh, great to be back. And again, always excited to talk about Wisconsin archaeology, prehistory, and history.
Well, it's been a lot of fun for me. As I said, the European discovery of the Americas, that's usually referred to collectively as the historic period. How did the changes in these peoples and their societies make things more difficult for an archaeologist? Or did it make it easier? I think it made it more difficult, didn't it?
Well, it did. So far on the program, we've covered really 13,000 years of cultural development, and the trajectory has been one of increased complexity and new technological developments, increased populations on the landscape. But we covered 13 millennia. And with the advent of the arrival of Europeans, the amount of change, of cultural change, accelerated at an unprecedented rate. Native peoples experienced dramatic changes in technology, in cultural practices, and political rivals with European powers, European diseases. Lots of change had happened within a relatively short period of time. But the terms that we use to describe this, the term that sometimes is used by professionals, proto-historic, refers to this window of time when Europeans are present, and we're talking primarily the French and the Eastern Great Lakes, and their influence pushed further to the west. And there's this period in Wisconsin from in the early 1600s up until the arrival of Nicolet in 1634 that European presence is felt here, but there may not have been Europeans directly in Wisconsin and in our adjacent areas until the 1630s, and that really begins a dramatic different type of interaction, and native lifeways are changed forever.
I think one of the earliest major effects, and you kind of alluded to it, of this European contact was this massive depopulation of native peoples, and mostly through disease, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, and it's really hard to imagine, and I think this is something that often when I taught Wisconsin archaeology on a regular basis, that students are just amazed to think about European diseases such as smallpox, measles, various strains of flu that spread ahead of European peoples, and this is before both Europeans and native peoples had an understanding of the biology associated with these types of diseases. And some of the archaeological estimates and estimates from reading some of the early historic documents, the Jesuit Relations and so forth, suggest that perhaps in a conservative estimate, is 60% of the native population died within first generation of contact with Europeans. And this is due to the fact that native peoples didn't have resistance to these diseases. They hadn't experienced them. They had been isolated populations for 13,000 years. And it had just a profound impact on native peoples. And when you think about those numbers, you think about the type of attention that the H1N1 virus is getting today. Imagine diseases that were fatal, where 6 in 10 people that you knew might die of a disease that you'd never seen before and didn't understand the mechanisms in which it spread. And it caused depopulation, collapsing of political structures and old patterns of doing things that within a very short period of time required native peoples to adapt to making a living very differently than how they lived prior to the arrival of Europeans.
Yeah, and how did they adapt?
Well, we know that in some cases that this depopulation caused the sort of shrinking of the aggregates of people that were living together, that in some cases agricultural practices declined, and in other cases people dispersed and moved back into hunting and gathering patterns. So it's no surprise, we talked about mound building last time, that mound construction, which involved significant numbers of people and complexity, really was not taking place in Wisconsin when Europeans first arrived. European disease and this depopulation may have accelerated or caused some of the collapse of the complexity that existed here prior.
And as we look at another aspect of this, I think is trade, European trade. It had some influence on the kinds of things that native peoples made for themselves, perhaps?
It certainly did. Europeans, of course, were using glass technology, alloyed metal technology, iron technology, brass kettles, complex textiles. Wool was a textile that, of course, was not available in the Americas, and it was a marvel of its day. It remained warm when it was wet. All of these types of things, as well as alcohol, became commodities that were brought into the Great Lakes, first by the French, later the English, and then traded by early American colonials to native peoples. And they interjected new technologies, and the trade mechanisms of establishing trading for furs and other commodities that native peoples had also caused a disruption in the cultural practices that existed prior to Europeans. Prior to the arrival of native peoples, most of the economy was based on subsistence and making a living. And when Europeans explored this region and saw the resources that, particularly in the case of furs, that native peoples had access to, it really changed the economy dramatically in a very short window of time.
Very short time. Chris in Madison has a question. By the way, if you'd like to join in, the number to call for you with your question is 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Chris in Madison now. Chris, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is related to some of those novel diseases that the Europeans brought with them. Is there any evidence that STDs were brought with, or were they already here?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There's quite a bit of research on this subject, and particularly the origins of syphilis and the relationship and exchange of syphilis between native populations and European populations. And it's something that I'm not immediately current on, but it's very easy to find access to researchers. And if you just do a quick search on the web, there are telltale signs and skeletal anatomy that indicate these types of diseases and how they spread, and clearly Europeans interacted and no doubt intermarried with Europeans, particularly or Europeans and native peoples, particularly in the case of the French, and so there's no question that some types of diseases were transmitted via these mechanisms.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. The historic period in the Great Lakes area was, I think it was a George Quimby who divided that kind of into three sections.
Yes, there are really four. Proto-historic, as I mentioned earlier, refers to this time period of in our case, with early 17th century, when there are Europeans in the eastern Great Lakes, but not directly in the western Great Lakes. The early historic period, from roughly 1610, in the case of Wisconsin, 1634, last to about 1670, and it's marked by this first exploration by the French into Wisconsin. And then the middle historic period, which is defined as approximately AD 1670 to 1760, is really the spread of the fur trade, the development of missionaries, the creation of outposts here in Wisconsin at places like LeBay and Green Bay, Prairie du Chien, LaPointe up in the Apostle Islands, and the establishment of a regular French presence in the region. And then the late historic period is marked by an increase in trade. The French are eventually supplanted by the English and eventually American control over what we call Wisconsin. And technologically, and from the archaeological record, we can see different types of European goods that mark the development of this historical sequence in terms of the types of interaction and the European powers that are present in Wisconsin.
And could you talk a little bit about those about that?
Sure. There's a real dramatic change in technology with the arrival of Europeans. I alluded to some of these technologies a little earlier. We see iron tools for the first time, things like, and very mundane but utilitarian tools, things like files and knives and axes and woodworking tools, fish hooks that were produced by Europeans to trade to Native Americans. One technology that shows up all across the Great Lakes with the arrival of Europeans is glass technology, and in particular glass beads. Native peoples had tremendous craft production in terms of ornaments and jewelry and decoration of costume and regalia, and Europeans were able to mass produce glass beads of a variety of different colors and forms that were highly sought after by Native peoples for decoration of clothing and costuming. And different beads were produced at different times in Europe, and so they are sometimes very good indicators of the age of an archaeological site when we see certain types of glass beads. Brass, in the form of kettles, cooking items made out of brass, it's common on early historic and middle historic sites to see Native peoples actually cut up these brass goods and turn them into other items because the metal was so valuable to them. One other technology that's quite intriguing Native peoples, of course, developed tobacco smoking. There was a lot of energy in the production of smoking pipes. Europeans saw this and began to mass produce smoking pipes and trade them back to Europeans. And they were often made out of white clays made by the thousands and brought over to the Great Lakes region and traded for furs. So a whole variety of technologies that weren't present that Native peoples were attracted to and often moved to locations where they had access to European trade.
Let's take some more calls. Linda in Green Bay, we turn to you next. Hi, Linda. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm kind of like going backwards here, but you often hear about how the Europeans always brought these illnesses that the Native Americans had no protection against. Were there any illnesses that the Indians had that the Europeans were susceptible to because they never had any immunity to them?
Oh, interesting question, too.
Very good question. And again, it's one I'm not an expert on the transmission of diseases during this time frame. There's quite a bit of published literature on it. Vectors of Death is an excellent resource or book that describes the type of interaction. But one of the things that's very different between Old and New World is that Native populations were isolated, again, for almost 13,000 years, versus European populations had interaction with very large areas, other continents, Africa, Asia, and had experience of contact with many different peoples over a very long period of time, and this allowed for the development of immunity to very wide range of diseases that Native peoples just simply did not have that kind of exposure to different groups of populations.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Tom Plager, Dean and Campus Executive Officer and Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW-Baraboo Sauk County Campus, as we take a look at the historic period in Wisconsin archaeology, Native peoples, and we'll talk a little bit about archaeology education as well. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we discuss the historic period in Wisconsin archaeology with Dean Tom Plager, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn back to the phones. Karen and Portage, give you a chance now. Hi, Karen. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I'm surprised there's now an anthropology archaeology department in Baraboo, because in 68 when I wanted to take it, I would have had to go to Whitewater. So you're gaining over there.
That's good.
We have three anthropologists on staff here.
I was born too soon. Buckskinners basically portray the fur trading era, which ended somewhere around 1830s. And there is dispute in what materials were used. And one big question which I was called on was the use of seed beads and the use of the snuff can lid tin cones. Now, some reading I've been doing shows a tin cone and a seed bead being back that far. Do you have an idea when seed beads and the tin cones were first utilized by the Indians?
Sure. The caller is referring to seed beads are these very tiny glass beads that were produced in the thousands. And the other artifact that she's referring to are, I believe, tinkling cones, which were often made out of a variety of types of metal, where they're conical cones that were sewn onto garments that basically make a bell or a tinkling-like sound. Glass beads show up in early historic times, and the seed beads, it's difficult. They're one of the forms that seem to transcend the entire historic period, these very tiny beads. And their first appearance is certainly in middle historic times, but how early they were producing these very, very tiny beads, I don't know the answer to that. Regards to the tinkling cones, or these cones that show up on garments, those were certainly made in middle historic times and into late historic times, and they were made out of a variety of types of materials, the can lids that you talk about, as well as sometimes made out of kettle brass, and they're items that are worn today on traditional dancers and native peoples in the Great Lakes, but they likely have their origins in middle historic times, if not earlier.
The date would be before 1830 or after?
Well, it depends on the material that they're made out of. I think there are examples of brass cones of these tinkling type cones that are much earlier than 1800s. But the more traditional type that you mentioned, made out of the can or lid, I believe, are later in time.
Mm-hmm. And the seed beads before 1830?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. I wonder if our guest would have anything to compare between the Russian eastward expansion in approximately the same time period that Western Europeans and Americans were moving west into our Aboriginal territories, with some similarities and some vast differences in consequences.
I don't know a whole lot about the Russian fur trade in you're talking about in Russia itself, or are you talking about the Russian expansion into North America?
I'm thinking of the Russian expansion into Siberia, into the Eurasian landmass.
Yes, I'm not an expert by any means in this, know very little, but where in many areas of the world where you see European powers moving into Aboriginal traditional lands, you see very similar types of patterns, and the same types of things happened in South America as well, in terms of the expansion and exploration, primarily due to resources, and those resources differ across time and space, but you have a very large dominant developed power moving into an area that usually has dispersed populations, and bringing new technologies, bringing new ideologies, and religion was a big change as well in the Great Lakes. But there's some very similar parallels around the world wherever this has taken place.
Yeah, very much so. And almost seems almost inevitable, doesn't it? And it always brings some large degree level of destruction to the native cultures and so forth.
And this period in the Great Lakes is a very intriguing period, because you have an economic interest by traders and European powers in terms of enhancing their wealth, both at the individual level, but also at the level of national levels in terms of countries. But you also have the interest in spreading Christian religion in the Great Lakes, which took place and expanded dramatically in this period, in the Middle Historic period, in the Late Historic, particularly the French missionaries and the Jesuits here to convert Native peoples to Christianity. And you have to remember that this is all taking place at a time frame, in a time period where there's a spread of disease and death, warfare, and it's a very unpleasant world, so to speak, and a new religion is very quickly spread across the Great Lakes region as a result of European influence as well.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Very interesting. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You mentioned the French, and I was hearkening my mind back to the Fox Native Americans who, in my readings, didn't really like the French very much, did they?
Well, the Fox, Sauk, and Meskwaki at one time were really coalesced into a related group and likely came from lower Michigan or moved into Wisconsin. And then, of course, the Fox Valley and the Fox River and that entire area is named at their present Sauk County, the area I'm in. But there was this period in Middle Historic times where they were trying to disrupt and control trade and aggravated the French to a great deal to the point that I believe it was in 716 that the French sent troops from Michilimackinac down to the Grand Village of the Fox near Little Lake or near Big Lake Butamore to the Bell site and really attacked and destroyed their main villages there. Jeff Baim at UW-Oshkosh has been doing just an outstanding job of extensive excavation and work at this original site and documenting that interaction that the Fox had with the French that eventually resulted in their dispersal out of that region and eventually out of Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, we have an email from Roger who wonders if you know anything about the Indian site just found near Highway 26 in Jefferson County.
I don't. if this is a Department of Transportation project, there's ongoing work that occurs constantly throughout the state when construction is taking place or planned. If this is a project that involves a survey, the State Historical Society would be involved and the State Archaeologist's Office. But archaeology is required with all highway construction and development, at least in the beginning of examining where the proposed highway is going to go, how it might impact known sites, and if the area hasn't been surveyed, there are archaeological surveys done ahead of the construction. And I'm not aware of immediate discovery that took place this summer on that particular roadway, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. You can join in, too, with your questions. The number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org as we talk with Dean Tom Plager about the historic period in Wisconsin archaeology and winding up our series of programs that we've done on Native people's lives in Wisconsin from way, way back and until almost to the present. Glad to have him with us today. And again, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call, and we'd be glad to get you on. And in fact, let's go to Norm in Waukesha. Norm, hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
When I was a kid, my dad and uncle bought a farm in Waukesha County on the Fox River. And the farm directly across the river from us had Indian mounds on it, and I don't know if they were protected or not. There was a little area off of their where they pastured cows, and I know it, but
Well, there were mounds. Thank you for bringing that up. The mounds, and we've talked about the mounds on past programs, but think about the loss of mounds. I'm sure we've lost a good percentage of the mounds that once existed, Tom.
Well, and again, the previous shows, and you can take a look at these on Larry's website and go back. And mound building starts about 2,500 years ago. but by the time Europeans arrived in Wisconsin, mound building was not taking place. That cultural pattern of connected with constructing these ceremonial centers and mortuary centers had disappeared. But certainly in late historic times, and very late, meaning the formation of the statehood and onward, we've seen a dramatic number of mounds that have been destroyed as a result of construction and earth moving. Fortunately, today Wisconsin is a very progressive state and has legislation and laws in place that allow us to protect the remaining mound sites that exist in our state.
Yeah. Thank you, Norm. Appreciate it. Sherry in Port Wing, on to you now. Hi.
Hello. Thank you. I was wondering, Tom, if you have... I should preface this by saying I've been studying algebra pictographs for about 30 years now. And I am not a part of the university system. I'm just an independent person. My father was an algebra person. And at any rate, I have a huge volume of research, and I'm encouraged to try to put this into some kind of book form, not for the ivory tower set, but for the general readership. But I wondered if you would know if there are scholars presently working in this field right now that I might be able to contact.
Yes, the question is about pictographs and petroglyphs. These are types of rock art petroglyphs are carvings, pictographs or paintings or drawings that are done on rock surfaces. There's a significant amount of this type of archaeological resource in the southwestern part of the state where we have rugged topography and rock outcrops. Much this artwork dates to the last 1,000 years, but could date considerably earlier. The majority of the information suggests that most of this was done during the last 1,000 years of prehistory and into historic times. There are a number of researchers working on this. Bob Salzer, an emeritus professor from Beloit College, Robert Ernie Bozart from UW La Crosse, the Wisconsin Archaeological Society are all active in research centered around this class of information that was produced in late prehistoric times. So there's quite a bit of research going on. I'd encourage you to contact the Wisconsin Archaeological Society and the State Historical Society.
Well, I would just like to make one point. Not meant to be dismissive, but we define petroglyphs as those images which are on rock, either painted or sometimes inscribed, and pictographs as those images which were inscribed usually on the cambium side of birch bark scrolls.
The two terms are used in the professional literature primarily that I'm familiar with to refer to rock art that is on the surfaces of geological features, and the distinction that I'm familiar with refers to the methodology in which the art is applied, but I'm not familiar with how the terms are used on other classes of material culture such as birch bark.
Mm. Interesting.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, as long as we're on that topic of scholarship, maybe we could talk a little bit about archaeology itself. How did you get involved? Your family lived along the shore of Lake Michigan, did it not?
Yes, I'm from Wisconsin, and I get asked this quite a bit about what types of career opportunities are there for archaeology. What if you're an interested person, or how do you study archaeology? And my interest developed growing up in northeast Wisconsin in Marinette, my family living on the water, finding artifacts in their backyard, so to speak, and became very intrigued with learning about how past cultures lived in the region prior to the modern landscape and prior to modern development and statehood, and started to explore that, became a member of the Wisconsin Archaeological Society, took a field school while I was in high school, and that led me down the career path, realizing that this could be done for a profession, and it's a great undergraduate career path in terms of a liberal arts degree, anthropology and archaeology, but it's also an opportunity to develop a career if you have an interest in history and prehistory.
And you attended college at UW La Crosse to begin with, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there very interesting institution. There are a number of University of Wisconsin campuses where you can study archaeology in the context of anthropology as part of an anthropology program. UW-La Crosse is the only University of Wisconsin campus that has a degree specific in archaeological studies, and their program is really founded in local research, started through the investigation of archaeological sites in the La Crosse area, and has really grown now to become a significant undergraduate institution. But students can also study at Milwaukee, Madison, Oshkosh, and at many of the two-year University of Wisconsin campuses, as well as Beloit College and Lawrence University, also have outstanding programs in Wisconsin.
And you actually received your Ph.D. at UW-Madison in archaeology anthropology.
Yes, and generally in Wisconsin and North America, to do archaeology as a professional, there are archaeological technician jobs that require a baccalaureate degree and some field school experience, but to practice professional archaeology, under most states, a master's degree in the field is required. And if you're interested in teaching at the university level or directing research at a museum or at that level, really the doctorate is necessary. But there are quite a few career options open in the private and public sector with a master's degree in the field.
What kinds of skills or what kind of personality you have to be successful in this whole field?
Well, I think curiosity and an interest in understanding the world around you. When I get asked, when people find out that don't know me that I'm an archaeologist, I am usually then asked, how wouldn't you like to work in Central America or in Egypt or in some exotic remote location? Certainly they don't envision places like Baraboo or Marinette, Wisconsin, but the archaeology of Wisconsin is in right out the back door is as fascinating as anywhere in the world, and I think people that have a curiosity about their landscape and how human beings have interacted with the landscape over time, that type of interest in history and prehistory and geology lends itself well to becoming an archaeologist.
Yeah, you know, I'm wondering about archaeology and anthropology. If you think about it, archaeology, if I'm not mistaken, is usually considered to be a division or a subfield of anthropology in North America.
In North America, archaeology has traditionally been one of the three or four subfields of anthropology. Anthropology is the study of human cultural and biological variation, as well as our ancestors and other living primates. And archaeology is the study of cultures through the material record, of the types of materials that they produce, in other words, artifacts, to learn and reconstruct human societies. And so it's often in the United States considered one of the three or four subfields. But there's now a growing trend in a number of universities where archaeology is developing as its own discipline, independent of anthropology.
That's interesting. Baraboo area history buffs were able to kind of take a little peek into the daily life of, was it Jacob Van Orden, that household?
Yes, their local...
talk about that a little bit. That was kind of interesting.
Our Sauk County Historical Society, which is very active in the region, their headquarters is located in this mansion of a distinguished community member. And just recently, with... I don't know if it was this relocation or movement of a tree, I think, stump. There was the discovery of a cistern connected with the Jacob Van Orden home, and it was filled with artifacts, filled with bottles and debris from early 20th century or late 19th century lifestyles. And historic archaeology is really the merging of historical documents and historical information with archaeology. And in this case, what appears to be debris and garbage is very useful in giving an insight into the everyday lives of these people. And that's the kind of information that historic archaeologists are interested in, looking for the material culture, the artifacts that can be linked with historic documents to further enhance and deepen the understanding of a particular culture. And historic archaeology encompasses a whole wide range of archaeological sites, shipwrecks, logging sites, really mining sites, where you're combining history of our state, in the case of Wisconsin, with material artifacts that are left in the ground to further understand how those people lived.
Dennis emailed and wonders why wheelbarrows or hand cars or dog cars weren't they in use here in the Americas before contact with Europeans, or were they not?
Not in the Great Lakes. There are no domesticated animals. There does not appear to be wheeled carts or any type of devices other than perhaps potentially in some areas of eastern North America, sleds that were used in the winter of some kind. But there weren't any type of mechanized transportation devices that were in place. And, of course, horses weren't here as well. So with the advent and arrival of Europeans, you have domesticated animals, including horses, firearms, many of the technologies that we discussed earlier, and wheeled carts and transportation devices.
Mary in Madison has a question or comment for you. Mary, hi.
Hello. Yes, during the Paleolithic, Paleo-Indian?
Yes, this is the first tradition, the first arrival of people during the Ice Age in the Great Lakes region.
Yes, you had mentioned a site, I believe, in that period where they were gathering materials for paint, and I was wondering, when did the first evidence of any sort of ritual or ceremony or religious practice came about?
Well, in North America, that is right from the beginning. There is evidence of Paleo-Indian sites that have ritual behavior on the Great Plains. There are carved artifacts that have been found made out of mammoth ivory and Pleistocene Ice Age megafauna animal bones. There's evidence of painting in the form of red ochre. So Native peoples, right from the very beginning of their arrival in the Americas, had artistic capabilities and connected a well-established ceremonial life, and that tradition extends all the way up to historic contact and into the present.
Interesting. Thank you very much for calling. Tom, this has been a lot of fun. By the way, were Indians, Native peoples, ever involved in the making of wine?
There doesn't appear to be any alcoholic beverages produced in the Great Lakes region. That is one of the technologies or commodities that Europeans brought to the Great Lakes. Brandy and whiskey and rum, but there does not appear to be any direct evidence of the production of alcohol here in Wisconsin prior to European contact.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Tom. I've really enjoyed visiting with you, and you're going to come back and be with us in January again, if I'm not mistaken.
I think December or January,
or December,
I'll be changing my hat to come back and talk about higher education and the University of Wisconsin Colleges and the University of Wisconsin Baraboosaw County in a liberal arts education. So it'll be a dramatically different subject matter. But I have enjoyed this series. It's been a great opportunity to talk with you and your listeners about Wisconsin archaeology.
Yeah, and I'm just to remind people that if you've missed any of the programs, you can go back. We've got all of them still up on our Wisconsin Public Radio website. Just go to my, just click on Larry Mueller, and you can find those programs. Tom, again, a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tom Plager is Dean and Campus Executive Officer and an Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW Baraboosaw County Campus. And that last question I asked him was about wine and wondering if Native peoples made wine. And one of the reasons I asked that was because we're going to be talking about winemaking next with Philippe Cocard, president and winemaker of Wallersheim Winery, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.